Good afternoon, everyone. This panel is Data on Deadline. I'm Ron Campbell from the NBC-owned television stations. This is Angela Caputo, just immediately formerly of the Chicago Tribune, and Andrew Tran of the Washington Post. I will be taking you through some sources you can get right now, this minute, online. Angela will be showing you how to recycle data that you've already pulled in from projects and turning it into deadline resources. Andrew will be batting cleanup, showing you how to develop a strategy for using data on deadline. And with any luck, we will go through all of this in 45 minutes, leaving 15 minutes for questioning at the end. Having already experienced the ups and downs of the internet at this hotel, I have put up several sites on the cache here so that, with any luck, we won't actually have any of these sites crash. And I'll keep this a little closer to me so you can actually hear me in the back. One of my favorite sayings, and I've got a lot of favorite sayings, is something from Samuel Johnson, the 18th century writer and wit. Okay, even closer. Who said, knowledge is of two kinds. We know a subject ourselves, or we know where we can find information upon it. And we journalists are not experts ourselves, but if we're any good at our jobs, we know where to find information on a given subject. One of my favorite places to find information on practically anything is the U.S. Census Bureau. Every year, they spend billions of dollars finding information about practically everything, then they give it away for free. And the place to go to find out information about something is American Fact Finder, factfinder.census.gov. Okay. If you just want information about a city or a county or a state, you just go to the default homepage of American Fact Finder and click on Community Facts. And for example, just type in Phoenix right here. And with any luck, you get the population and a variety of tabs that'll show you information about Phoenix or any other city you put in there. But if you want really detailed information, you click on Advanced Search. And a feature I really love about Advanced Search is not the ever-present chance to participate in a Census Bureau survey, but instead the opportunity to click and find information on any given address anywhere in the country. And the address we're going to pick is the address for Phoenix City Hall. And once again, we see how slow the internet is at this hotel. And we get about 24 different geographies here, all of which contain this Phoenix City Hall. The one I'm going to pick is Census Tract 1141, Maricopa County, Arizona. A census tract has between 1,000 and 4,000 people. And now, as you see, my selections basically include Census Tract 1141. I'm just going to eliminate Phoenix, Arizona, so that the only geography is Census Tract 1141. And at this point, if I can, I'm going to eliminate the geography. And there are now 8,464 tables of information free that the census has for this particular place, for this census tract, that I'm able to get just with a few clicks of a mouse. For example, marital history. If I want to know marital status, I can find out how many people are married. Of each race. How many are divorced? How many were never married? Again, just a click of a mouse. Now think about this for a second. If you've got any geography you want, it's not just people who are married. No. You can look about school enrollment, educational attainment, languages spoken at home, almost anything the census collects just for that one geography. And again, it's free for that one geography, very easy. Suppose you want to know how many immigrants there were in that one area. You could find that again just by clicking. Place of birth. And now you know for that one area how many were native, how many were foreign born, and where they were from. Nonprofits. There's a good chance you were born in a nonprofit hospital. You may have gone to a nonprofit university. There's a fair chance that when you die, your bones will rest in a nonprofit cemetery. And yet, nonprofits get relatively little or coverage from news organizations, and when they do, it tends to be fawning. We treat them so nicely, we assume they're always nice people. They don't deserve it. What we really need to do is the same thing we do with governments and with business. We need to follow the money. My personal favorite way of following nonprofits is a wonderful site called GuideStar. How many of you use GuideStar or other places? Good. It should be all of you. Wonderful way to get into a nonprofit is to go to GuideStar or a site like that, and to look up a nonprofit and to see what its finances are. What I really like about GuideStar is its power search. I'm going to get used to the search mechanism, to the way the buttons on this machine. It takes me all session. You can search by state. What I really like about it Now, I've gone from about 70,000 nonprofits to 5,368. And from there, I can go and choose a type of organization. That's not the one I wanted. Can you tell I'm used to using a Mac? And then you can choose financials. And you can then choose that you want about $10 million in revenue. And at this point, there are only two out of those 5,000 organizations. And maybe it'll work. And now we've chosen that one organization, and now as you see here, we've got 990s.
I'm just wondering if you're looking at a certain state or you're looking at the organization. Can you explain a little bit more? Because we're going to have to see.
Yes. What I've done is I've decided I want to look just in Arizona, I want to look just at food charities, and I want to look just at those that have got at least $10 million in revenue. I just want to look at big food nonprofits in Arizona. Out of all the hundreds of thousands of nonprofits GuideStar has. So I've narrowed the search. And now I want to see the 990s. And now I'm getting it. And here it is. And I can download it. In fact, I can download the last 3 years. One more thing to show you. How many of you use Edgar? How many of you are wondering who the hell Edgar is? Edgar is a way of searching for business records for public corporations. If you sell stock to the public, you must file forms with the Securities and Exchange Commission. And it shows up here under company filings. One of the largest companies in Arizona is a company called Freeport McMoRan, which is a mining concern. There are a whole bunch of filings for Freeport-McMoRan, as you would expect for a multi-billion dollar company. There are filings like an 8K, which is a filing made anytime there is a material event, which can be almost anything, including a press release. An S-4, a securities filing when somebody buys or sells stock. 10Q, a quarterly report. A 10K, an annual report. And my personal favorite, a DEF 14A, which is a proxy issued to stockholders once a year, which includes that loveliest of all corporate filings, executive pay. I think I know what you'd like to see. DEF 14A. And you see this up here, filter results? Now, behold, all those hundreds of filings, we're only seeing the DEF 14As. Here is the most recent one. And there's the table of contents. And we're just going to scroll down here. Executive officer compensation. Executive compensation tables. What say we go there? And unfortunately, this is impossible to read. And what's the key here to enlarge? I can never remember. Control plus. And it's down here again. Can you see this, any of you? Mm-hmm. Okay, the Vice Chairman, President, and Chief Executive Officer, Richard C. Atkerson, in 2016 made a grand total of $15,982,666, which is slightly more than I made working for NBC. In the previous year, he made $8,570,791, so he got a slight raise. And I think I'm out of time. But this is an example of what you can find if you know your way around online records. Now, there is a handout which goes through a lot more records than I was able to get time for. And we will be showing you the links to all the handouts at the end. Angela, you're on. And let's see, there's... Actually, let me get yours up. There you are.
Okay. So hi, I'm Angela Caputo. I'm from Chicago for now. And you know, I don't know, it's kind of at this sort of conference, I think people do all sorts of different things under investigative umbrella in the newsroom. I'm an enterprise reporter. I do investigative reporting, but I also have data skills. So sometimes I get pulled into other things that aren't, you know, my enterprise stories, where I'm a helper, and I love it. I think it's like a great way to add value to your newsroom, and also to sort of, you know, become more valuable to yourself in your newsroom. You know, it's like good for your career. When people know they can come to you and say, hey, Caputo, I'm on deadline for this. Can you look something up for me, or can you help us to figure this out? So I'm going to kind of go through some examples of things that I've worked on recently. Let's see. So I guess the first thing is, you know, your editor comes to you and says, you know, Caputo, you know, the there was a shooting in Chicago. We want to know everything we can about the circumstances of this shooting. I don't know. So you're thinking, well, what data is available? How easy can I get it? What can I get that I can analyze and turn around really quickly? Because obviously this editor is in a big hurry. So, you know, this is like one way that I found that I could add value in the newsroom is to, you know, sort of background something that's breaking, but also to put like a something that's happening quickly in context. So an example of that is, you know, this little girl was shot, and there have been a lot of shootings in Chicago, but here's this one particular shooting, and so we were able to quickly turn around something where we could put this shooting to understand, like, why does this keep happening? Why do kids keep getting killed in Chicago? What, you know, and really just by telling the story of this one, we could understand, you know, something, a bigger point. And so one thing that we knew was that this little girl was shot right outside of this housing development called Parkway Gardens. And Michelle Obama lived there when she was a toddler. It's like this sort of famous, you know, it has a historical significance. It's on the Registry of Historic Places, the National Registry, because it's been important, African-American housing, especially, you know, during segregated, when Chicago was, well, Chicago is still segregated, but when it was enforced by housing laws. And so right away I thought, well, let me go back to what I know. Let's go to HUD data and try to understand what this housing looks like. So by going to this multifamily housing data site, and I've got links to this that I can share with you, I was able to quickly figure out how many units are in there, what is the fair market rent for each unit size, so I could do just like a quick calculation and find that this landlord is bringing in about $10 million a year in rent for this little apartment complex. And, you know, we learned that it's this company called Related Realty, and it's a big, you know, high-end, fancy real estate company. And then through this data, we're also able to find, hey, look, they're on a buying spree. They bought up, like, thousands of units of low-income housing in Chicago. And this is a company that's typically associated with, like, big, fancy skyscrapers. And so, you know, they're finding value in this industry. And they own this one where these children keep getting shot. What is going on here? So that, you know, that's like some pretty interesting data that you can get on this, you know, this one breaking event of a child dying. Also, in Chicago, we have a lot of crime data. That's great. It's on a portal. I would say if you don't have access to this, it's really important to make sure somebody in your newsroom is compiling this on an ongoing basis so you have it to go back to. You know, I was able to do a quick spatial join and figure out what kind of crimes are happening in this area. And, like, this is all stuff that you can do within a day or two to turn around a story. It's really not complicated data once you know it exists. And then this was the story that came out. Here is this bougie company that is on a buying spree of all of this low-income housing, and they're bringing a lot of rents, and it's not getting any better. This messed-up housing complex is still messed up. So that sort of added another dimension to this. What's happening in our city, a lot of shootings, but it's a different way of looking at it, and it's a different way of trying to understand, you know, this sort of, and develop this breaking news event. And so these are the links, you know, I included, and you guys can find this on the thing. Obviously, I'm not very skilled. I didn't add titles. Sorry, guys. But I'll fix that before I post it. But again, these are, you know, these basic HUD data portal points that I found. City of Chicago. Oh, and the third point that I found that was really good is I also got 311 calls because I wanted to see what do people who live there, what are they complaining about? Are they calling a lot? Is it in good shape? You know, I looked at the inspection scores and I saw if the federal standards, you know, they weren't meeting them on inspections. And people are calling and there were like roaches and rodents and all kinds of stuff that you wouldn't imagine would be happening in this housing complex that's been showered with with money, really. I mean, tons of low-income housing tax credits and all kinds of money going into it. So if you read the story, you'll see there are many different data points you could collect. Here, I just want to show you how I used a lot of the same data sources. So if you get some good data, steady data, and this comes with just practice, right? And over time, you find something, it exists, just keep it. Like, hang on to it, make a mental filing cabinet, create files on your desk of, like, just standard data that you can go back to and use in different circumstances. But here, there's this housing complex. People have been living on it. It was a Superfund site. They knew there was lead contamination for many, many, many years, but all of a sudden, a new mayor came in and it was an emergency. They realized how bad it was. And so these people were moving really quick. And so they were saying, don't worry, we have so many good options for these families. You know, they're going to have many good places to go. And so with data, we were able to kind of, you know, see if that was true. So again, I went back to my HUD data to confirm, because there were like inaccurate numbers of how many units the rent brought in, the inspection scores. I could go back and find that all for myself through those data portals. Through the HUD data. And then through the crime data, again, I did another little spatial join, because they were saying, oh yeah, we're taking people to this one housing complex. It's not far away. There's plenty of housing. And I found that there were, like, just hundreds and hundreds of, like, bad crime incidents recently. And, you know, it's kind of people at the housing complex were saying, well, I don't want to move there because it's dangerous. And I was able to quantify that. Like, these people are being told, go. And there's this other great place that you could move, but it wasn't so great. Then I also found, again, with HUD, a lot of families said they wanted to move to this other community that was close by. It was like more white, the schools are better, it's just a nicer place to live. But I was able to find in, on data.gov, all of these fair housing complaints, and I found like the number of fair housing complaints in that area. So I was able to show people were also trying to get into this place quickly, where there was a history of people complaining that they landlords weren't accepting them. So that was like another layer. This is all quick stuff that just in time covering stuff, you know, you'd be surprised how much you know, or you guys probably know that, but if you just start thinking in data and sort of store these things away, you can take the same stuff and use it in so many different scenarios. And then obviously PACER, I wanted to see, were there any lawsuits against this public housing development? And then it was on a Superfund site, so I found all kinds of great stuff about it on that EPA site. And then what was pretty cool was that I was able to develop an even bigger investigation out of it, you know? So this is like a great thing. Sometimes when you pinch hit, you get involved in these like quick breaking things, it turns into something bigger and better. And I found that it was like pretty amazing. I should have put the map up, but over 25 years, imagine this is the Superfund site. This is the public housing development. They tested everywhere except the public housing development, and they tested like, you know, five different times in different years, like all of these little test sites. And it was like the question was, how could you test everything except the public housing development? And it sort of makes you wonder if it's that they didn't want to actually show what was happening there. And then, you know, you can dig deep, use this data to dig deeper into a different kind of breaking story. So when Aaron Schock, one of our congressmen, he suddenly quits, and they say, why did he quit? And, you know, he's not indicted yet, and we don't know what's going on, so you know how it is. You scramble to figure out, what can we find out? How can we kind of figure out what is going on here? You can turn to data for some sources. We went to disbursements.house.gov, and again, you'll get these in the links, but this is basically like the expense account of members of Congress. So you can see line by line each person, the check they were cut for mileage, you know, or for office supplies or anything, a meal expense. And then also we went to FEC.gov. .gov, and you know, it's just finance, campaign finance information, which is pretty cool. You can like download tables to do something more advanced, or you can just search, you know, an individual's name to see like, could this guy be involved? Did he give him money? If you get a tip, or you know, think maybe that maybe you figured it out, and can you prove it? But with these sources, you know, we did like this initial thing, and you know, we looked at the mileage on his car, and is it like all of this travel, and sort of like we're able to talk about some of the controversy around him with his money, like that set him apart. Like, could it be this? Could it be the fact that he's done these things that look pretty spendy for a member of Congress? And then, but it turned into like this whole series of things that we used out of, I mean, we kept going because I don't think the guy was indicted for at least another year. And we were like looking at donor swapping. We were trying to figure out like how many donations were made within certain windows. And, you know, were there people who never donated to him who donated to other people? And it was pretty fun. I've never done anything like that, but it's like through the data, I was able to cross over into something that isn't what I typically do, which is, you know, it's kind of exciting, you know, because you get a little jolt of something different. And you're also helping your newsroom, which is great. So, you know, you can, well, and one last thing I wanted to talk about. Am I running out of time? How am I doing on time? Okay. Yeah. I don't want to take too long. But, you know, like, as investigative reporters, we, like, build databases, we mash databases up, we have so much stuff that we create, and we do these, like, big investigations, and that just sits there. And I've been trying to figure out how to share that stuff as needed. And I think that a lot of this is just about, like, communication within your newsroom and sort of making yourself available to people that you don't ordinarily work with. So, like, the breaking news desk will come over to me all the time and say, hey, Angela, can you look up, you know, police officer complaints or lawsuits? And this was based on, you know, some projects that we did. We tracked every police shooting, and so we know every officer who was involved in a shooting. When an officer gets a promotion, we can go back and look, hey, has this guy ever shot anyone? We found that actually our police chief was in the shooting database. So, you know, you can find, like, really unrelated, interesting stuff later, or just sort of if you're interviewing and you want to scrub someone, you're writing something nice about it, something an officer does, you want to know, like, has he ever shot anyone? Because maybe you don't want to write some dumb puff piece and miss the story, right? Another investigation I did where I built a database about police officers and lawsuits, so then I could go back when somebody was writing about a particular police officer or a lawsuit, could go back and say, you know, this, yes, he was in this many other cases, or, you know, he was sued with this cop before how many times, because I basically was able to look at the partners who were sued a lot together. So that's been useful outside of just the big project that I did. But I would say, like, in order to do all this stuff, the important stuff is to be prepared. And it's just the more practice you have, and the more stories you write, the more information you compile. And so hoard it. And when you get something good, and it's not publicly available, just keep asking for it, because it will become useful, and in a context you might not ever even imagine. So keep it fresh. Keep refoying the same data so you have it, and you can say something over a longer period of time. If you got something really good once and you fought like hell to get it, it's great when you FOIA again for it, because they just give it to you because you already broke them. So just keep collecting stuff. Know where publicly available data is. And then, you know, just think about how you can take, like, these big projects you've already done and repurpose them so that you get more life out of it, and you're really supporting other people in your newsroom and it, you know, helping to support them and making sure that they got it right and they got the full story. Okay. That's it.
Okay. How are we going to get in this? Oh, the HTML paper?
No.
I'll just move to his desk.
Okay.
Andrew Tran. I'm the data reporter for the Washington Post's new, I guess they're calling it the Rapid Response Investigative Team. I know it's a weird name, but pretty much I'm responsible for working with data and working with it quickly. So, this is... we'll see. So the website, I guess, where we're putting all our slides, or links to get to our slides, is bit.ly/IREDOD. Oh, thank you. bit.ly/IREDOD. All lowercase. DOD, yeah, DOD for data on deadline. And I don't know what's not working on here. But, oh, I'm spelling it wrong.
Sorry, can you say the link one more time?
Yeah, bit.ly/IREDOD. All lowercase. So, luck is what happens when opportunity meets preparation. So my kind of gist for this talk is trying to anticipate data and planning ahead so that when you do get it, you're not overwhelmed by it. So think about it before you get it. Let's say... you have education data that you know will be dropping soon, right? You can plan ahead for it. You can figure out the structure of the data, because the greater the level of detail you have, the more options you have for analysis. Okay, so what does your story need? You need to communicate with your team. What do your designers and developers need? What do the reporters need? And then you can make a list of the steps you'll take for the data process, like step one, filter, step two, sort, three, pivot table. And so this is very minute details, but it's good to list this out, because it's just later on when you're just inundated with all this, you can just have something to follow right away. All right. So what answers do you want to derive? And you got to ask, what format is it in? So this is an example of some... I guess they're called the Smarter Balance test scores. So every year, the standardized test scores come out, and the education reporter will come up to me. This is before the Washington Post, I was at the Connecticut Mirror, and the education reporter said, oh, by the way, this test scores are coming out tomorrow at around 8, and the embargo lists at 10, so you've got 2 hours to work with this data. All right, so I'm sure many of you have worked with that type of situation before. So even with the embargo, there's not enough time, right? 2 hours is not enough to do all this. So we need to plan ahead. So the data came in an Excel sheet, kind of like this, with a workbook, and had multiple sheets, dozens of sheets at the bottom, schools, districts, everything. And so there's so much data, so it's crucial to communicate with the editor and the reporter on what answers they want. All right, otherwise, you could end up going down this rabbit hole and doing extra work that ultimately isn't needed in the story or isn't ultimately needed in the interactive that your team is making. So we put together a list and categorize them as must-haves and would like to have if there's time, okay? So for this story, the reporter needed last year's scores compared to this year's. And the story's on the right. So I pretty much got the data, and I created this custom sheet for them and sent it to them so that they could figure that out and write around it. Now, for our interactive developer, he needed the data in this format on the left called JSON, okay? And so that it would, so he could build the front end, make it a kind of a searchable interactive thing here. And so it was my job to, so everyone on the team had different elements to work on and that they needed. And so I piped them the only things that they needed to accomplish their goal, and filtered out the rest. So you want to find the gatekeeper. of the data when you're on data on deadline. Speak to the person who's responsible for it or the person who has access to it. If you can, get them to describe this data structure so that you can build the data's dummy data set on your own so that you can make that list I was talking about of steps you needed to do to work on the data. If possible, get a copy of last year's data, okay? So that's what you can work with so you know ahead of time what possibilities there are. By doing this for one of the test scores, we learned ahead of time that the smarter balance scores would be presented in a different way. As you can see, 2015, the scores were way more specific, 1, 2, 3, 4. But then 2016, as we learned a little bit ahead of time, they combined the lowest scores together so that it would not look as bad. So that no one could see exactly how, in the far behind achievement levels schools happened to be. They would only be wrapped up in the ones and twos, right? Far behind achievement level and approaching achievement level, those were combined. So that was that presented a new story because we knew ahead of time that the data was going to be obfuscated. Okay, so when you're on deadline, you just in data in general, be organized. Don't have a blank spreadsheets folder, please. Each story should get its own folder within a year, month subfolder, okay? And keep raw versions of your data separate from your process data. So, think of how you recall a story from memory. You would search for it based on a keyword or a subject, you Google it, and then you look up the month and the date, and then that's how you find your story online, right? Well, that's how you should find your data that you've used before so that you can recycle and use for future stories or when there's a new option. Okay, so when you're doing data on deadline, do what you know how to do first, okay? Use whatever method you're used to complete the story quickly and correctly. Let's see. This is a story my team did recently, how Jared Kushner was gerrymandering luxury skyscrapers, qualifying for federal funds that was meant for job-deprived areas. And as the map pretty much just shows the gerrymandered census tracts, the project is in the light blue census tract, which has pretty much like 2% unemployment. But by gerrymandering it to all these like really high unemployment areas, he was then able to qualify for funding. So just trying this out, if you were going to try to analyze and map unemployment rates by census tract in Jersey City, this is the process you would do by hand. Okay, you go to the census website, you'd find the table of data, download the data and clean it up, find a shapefile for all the census tracts in New Jersey, join the unemployment rate data table to the shapefile using a program like QGIS, and if that's how you know how to do it, great. But then after you've done it, you've got the story out there, and you've got to give yourself a little bit extra time to do it better, okay? Do it better and more efficiently. Remember the list you created early on? When I was talking about detailing the steps of your analysis process, I mean, that's the basis for script writing, data analysis script writing, okay? All the stuff I mentioned earlier that you would do by hand took about 350 lines of code in R. All right. And I could iterate it through different groups of census tracts if the reporter came to me and said, hey, actually, the project was on this list and these are the tracts. Instead of doing it by hand, I could just change the variables in here and I could even change the census data by switching some variables around. And it would generate these maps very quickly and efficiently, and I could present, and we could talk about it. Exploratory. So if you're serious about working quickly with data, you need to learn a language for data analysis such as R or Python. Okay. Investigative journalists have always relied on the practices of social scientists, and one thing I'm going to mention is the concept of reproducible research. And the idea is that data analysis and more generally, stories are published with their data and software code so that others may verify their findings and build upon them. But the thing is, your audience for this type of documentation is not only others in the field, it's you, yourself, in a few months or later on when you're trying to do the same thing, trying to apply the same practices you did before on a new data set. Another strategy for data on deadline is partner with other news organizations. When the Trump inauguration data was put out, they could have put it in an electronic format for people to scroll through, but they didn't. They put it on PDF formats, and it was un-OCR'd. So a bunch of us, the Washington Post, New York Times, ProPublica, all kind of teamed up and scraped different parts of it. Another thing you could try to do is crowdsource your data if you need help cleaning it up. This is one from Christina Wilkie, from formerly of the Huffington Post. And using Trump inauguration donor data that we parsed, she enlisted her followers on Twitter to help flag and add comments to 1,500 donors. They found that some people in places listed did not exist. One address was a vacant lot in Jersey, and one donor was supposedly the NASA mathematician from that movie Hidden Figures. So her efforts led to a formal complaint to the Federal Election Commission. I need a request. Another thing is, it's weird. One thing, and I don't know if I can make this work, but all right, I'm just going to put it back. So what this image would show you is, if the internet would load, is oftentimes when you're iterating a scraping, here we go. When I'm iterating through a scraping process, I won't be able to get it until it's fully done. Sometimes I'm scraping a lot of stuff. One strategy I've recently implemented is when it's iterating, I will put every line on Google Sheets so I can share with other people, with my team members, who they can also, because Google Sheets is great because you can work on spreadsheets at the same time with other people, and so they can clean up data at the same time. So I call it the Google Sheets iterator, or the shiterator. So another thing I want to show, repeating a process that you often do, figure out a way to toolify it, okay? If you're doing something over and over again, figure out a way to put it into a function, and it'll save you time in the long run. One thing that often I run into, and you yourselves probably run into, is when you're working with raw data, sometimes the town names don't line up exactly with the census version of the town name. Sometimes they're villages or hamlets or something, right? So I created this package in R that then I ported to a Shiny, a website server, where if you put in upload a spreadsheet, then it will append the, and you select the column name with all the town names in it, it will then append the correct, it will refer to a Google Sheet that and append the correct name to it, all right? And so I've kind of crowdsourced, open-sourced this to a bunch of people in Connecticut who deal with this type of situation regularly. And every time they run it through this app, it will give them a list of, you know, town names that didn't match. So then they can go to the spreadsheet and add their name, those town names that didn't match, so that every time they run it through again, you know, it's a self-growing list, and people keep, it's a crowdsourced list. And so then if I ran this accidental drug deaths data through this name cleaner, I can quickly do a pivot table and make a map of it quickly. Whereas before, if you were trying to fix names, you'd have to do it manually. So those are some tips. And I guess we're going to open up some questions.
If you could, please, if you've got questions, come up to the microphone.
Not all at once.
Since there are more than 100 of you.
Hi, guys. Do you guys use data.gov that much? I'm not sure what's going on with it now, if it's still being maintained. It seems like a lot of out-of-date stuff on there. It used to be kind of useful, but any idea where that's going?
Data.gov does appear to be outdated, but it's spawning some relatives. For example, FactFinder is going away. I think sometime in early 2018 is going to be replaced by data.census.gov. One of my resolutions post-IRE is to spend some quality time looking at data.census.gov to see if it's a worthy successor. We shall see. More to report at NICAR. Also, data.medicare.gov is a treasure, and it is maintained, updated every quarter.
Medicaid, right?
Actually, there's also data.medicaid.gov, but data.medicare.gov is just amazing, absolutely amazing. But data.gov is so-so, and in my opinion, they've not been maintaining it since January 20th.
Hi, is there a program or way to scrape things? Like, for example, police data, they just kind of type it out on the website, and it's just page after page after page. How would you get that from there? Is there an easy way other than just retyping it?
There are books that you can get on scraping. You probably are better equipped than I am.
If you don't want to learn stuff on something like Python or JavaScript, there are websites or that services. I guess you would call them freemium. The downside to that is where you can just kind of point and click and then train it to scrape it for you. The downside is because it's freemium, they will eventually try to charge you money for it, for the service. And I used to suggest something like import.io, but you know, after they hook people in, they're like, okay, we need to start charging money for this. And so then they limit the accessibility for it. But the thing is, there's always scraping data is a big business. So even though import.io has moved on, there's other ones that are popping up. And I think, I can't remember off the top of my head, but there's a recent Quora website question where people ask that, what's the alternative to import.io? And people list like half a dozen of them. So they are out there.
There's also a book, I believe the title is Scraping for Journalists. I'm trying to remember the author's name.
Paul Bradshaw.
Paul Bradshaw, thank you. It's an excellent book. I recommend it. And no, I've not been paid to recommend it. Well worth getting.
Hey, so I'm just wondering if you have any personal tips to how you manage what data you're going to go for or how you're going to approach something in a breaking news situation. Like you were mentioning, Angela, like when the shooting happened, you were like, okay, this is the, you know, I'm going to go for what's the situation with this complex where this little girl died. Like I feel like so often we're just like, something happened and then what are officials saying, blah, blah, blah. But then how can you start moving on from there to quickly figure out what's the best way?
What, yeah,
I know it totally depends on the situation, but.
Yeah, I mean, I guess part of it just comes from, like, knowing the place you're covering, right? So we knew there were a lot of shootings that were happening at this one place over and over, and then this child is killed, and, you know, it's been said to have more shootings than any other block in Chicago, and we wanted to find out if that were true. But then also just, you know, hearing people complain, say, like, hey, do you know who owns that place? And then that got us thinking, like, well, that's interesting. And then just having reported on totally different things, like public housing in the past, completely unrelated to this, I said, oh, hey, I know where we can just get this data. And so, I don't know, does that answer your question? Or you want to be something more specific? Yeah, and I think that, you know, a lot of it, too, is, like, not just having data, but thinking about how to use things creatively, right? Like, that's how you can figure out these neat things. Like, you know, not just having crime data, but being able to, like, do a spatial join really quickly to say, like, well, what does this little place say? And, you know, and that's easier because it's just, you know, a small little join. So it's really just like you just need the bread and butter data. I mean, everybody should have, you know, data about their school districts in the area. Everybody should have a shapefile handy of every community area in Chicago and census tract and crime data. And, you know, there's just basic stuff that, you know, that you or someone in your newsroom should have on hand. So when something happens, you can move with it, you know? But it's all about, it's not just having data, it's thinking, you know, about why it matters in this context or what question you have and can you answer it with the data.
Picking up on that, just think about your community for a second and think about what kinds of databases are just available under your state public records law. If voter reg is available in your state, you should have it, period, no question. If shapefiles for your city and county are available cheap, you should have it, no question. That kind of thing you should simply have and you should update regularly. For example, I live in California. Wildfires are a fact of life. If someone is living in what's known as the urban-rural or urban fire interface, you need shapefiles for that area because someone may get burned out there and you want to know who's living there or who might get burned out and when the next fire breaks out. And you don't want to have to guess.
All right, like Ron was saying, be a hoarder, okay? If you find you stumble across some interesting data, save it. You never know when you'll need it again.
Piling on that, make yourself a schedule of when to go update new data so that you just have ticklers to say, okay, I need to go get that. So, like, spend your part of your FOIA Friday going to update your data records. An alternative to the Census Fact Finder is censusreporter.org, a night sponsored project that is just a great, great resource to get those quick facts. It's a really beautiful and well-done site. And Paul Bradshaw, that
Joe
book
Kermeska.
What's that?
Joe Kermeska's site.
Yeah, it's a really, really good source. And that Paul Bradshaw book, Scraping for Journalists, he also has one on Excel spreadsheets that's really good. And they're like cheap as dirt. They're like $10 or something or $15.
Also, if you use our Python, Census API is excellent.
You had mentioned getting your voter registration information if it's available. So my newspaper did that, and it cost us, like, some people's monthly salaries probably. It cost us so much money, and then we kind of got it, and we're like, what can we even do with this, you know? So do you have any suggestions? If you go through that, it was kind of sad for us. We went through a lot of effort, big fight, got the data, and you really just have a list of everyone who lives in your county and where they live.
Okay, yeah, the cost varies hugely from state to state. I mean, you know, obviously in a state where it's cheap, the advantages are huge. When it's expensive, you just kind of look at your editor or news director with a very long face and hope you can use it sometime. But the things you can use it for, someone dies or, you know, gets killed in a bizarre way, you can instantly look up and double-check the name, double-check the age, which is, you know, if you really want to know who lives at the same house, who lives next door, find out, what can you tell me about this mass murderer? Oh, he was quiet. Have you ever noticed they're always quiet? But, I mean, you can use it for location. You can find out who lived at the same address. You can double-check ages. I mean, all kinds of utility purposes like that that have nothing to do with politics. Though, of course, it's useful for politics, which is probably the reason you got in the first place. But again, hoard it. And for God's sakes, when you update it, don't throw away the first one.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you for coming. I think our time is up.